All right, so at first we have Mitchell Mallory here on Universal Salvation, and I'll just go ahead and let him go because he's going to know what he's talking about. So basically, we'll go 20 minutes, hopefully. I'll try to watch and look toward you and so we get time for questions before we get to the next speaker and so forth. All right?
Thank you. So, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. In the incarnation, Christians believe that God brought heaven to earth. And in the ascension, God took earth to heaven in the body of Jesus. And in the new creation, heaven and earth become one. And all of this happened even though the earth killed the God from heaven. But in a surprising twist, God chose to save the earth when he raised the earthly body of Jesus into the heavenly life of the resurrection. This, says the Bible, is our future. This is our hope. Hello, my name is Mitchell Mallory, and today I want to talk about the fourth pillar of the biblical narrative, the hope for the new creation. In particular, I want to discuss two main topics, the salvation of non-human life and the ethical implications that arise for Christian living. In short, my argument is that Jesus' resurrection and the subsequent promise of the new creation demand that Christian ethics be grounded not in protology, the study of origins, but rather in eschatology, the study of the end, not in recreating the Garden of Eden, but in preparing the way for the New Jerusalem. That was a lot to take in, so let's talk about Easter, shall we? In my theological program, Easter is of paramount importance. Not only is it the foundation of all faith as such, but it is also the paradigm for all eschatological reflection. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, the first act of new creation in cosmic history, is not only the paradigm for humanity's future resurrection, but also for creation's as well. But what exactly is the nature of Jesus' resurrection? The first point I wish to make is just about that. We must connect the crucified Jesus with the resurrected Christ. Though this seems obvious, what I'm suggesting is that there is genuine continuity between the two. Let me explain. The Docetic heresy in the early church maintained that Jesus only appeared to be human, but was in fact only spirit. Unfortunately, Docetism is the heresy which is most prominent in discussions on the resurrection of Jesus Christ. For here, it is too often assumed that Jesus' divine nature was raised on Easter morning, but not his human nature. The human left behind, the spirit raised anew. The problem with this, however, is the dualistic tendency to leave the world, that is, Jesus' human body, out of any and all accounts of salvation. But the Apostle Paul implores us to avoid just such a conclusion when he states that if Christ has not been raised, our faith is in vain and we are still in our sins. Moreover, the resurrected Jesus himself concurs with this point, telling his disciples in Luke, "See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." Consequently, because the resurrected Jesus was recognized by his disciples through the scars of crucifixion, it can be concluded that it was the crucified human body of Jesus, which was raised on Easter morning. Continuity. The second point I want to argue is that, echoing Paul's impressive rhetoric in 1 Corinthians 15, is that the future of humanity is not an ethereal bliss in the heavenly beyond, but is in fact bodily resurrection. By this, of course, I mean that just as Christ was physically raised from the dead, so too will we. Paul states, "If Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? If Christ has not been raised, or if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not been raised. Moreover, Christ, says Paul, was the first fruits of those who have died. As such, just as death came through one person, so too the resurrection of the dead has come through another. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive." This is a point which cannot be overstated. First is Christ's resurrection, the first fruits of the harvest. Following this, at his second coming, all those who belong to him, the reaping of the harvest. But what exactly is the nature of this new bodily existence? Paul describes this new body as a spiritual, imperishable body. But it's not subject to the suffering and transience of human mortality. This is not to be confused with being merely a spirit, however, for Jesus' own indication that he had flesh and bones after his resurrection indicates that this is the case. Ontologically speaking, there is indeed continuity and discontinuity between the initial creation and the new creation. As the front of our programs to the ASA handout indicate, it is precisely the perishable body, which Paul says puts on the imperishable one. Just like Jesus, therefore, ours will be a physical resurrection, both a restoration and a transformation of our earthly bodies into imperishable ones. The third point I want to argue is that Jesus' resurrection is the first act of new creation in cosmic history, and as such, is a proleptic prefiguration of the new heaven and the new earth. That was a mouthful, so let me unpack this. Just as Jesus' own resurrection was both a restoration and a transformation of his earthly body, so too, the new creation will be both a restoration and a transformation of this very world. Although it's unfortunately common in the Western tradition to portray salvation as an escape from this world, biblical eschatology speaks of a salvation of this world. That's not an insignificant difference. The escapist narrative, influenced by both Platonism and the dispensational project for the last 150 years, is not just an alternative eschatological option for Christian faith and practice. It is, essentially, a total rejection of Easter and all that it stands for. The vision of a future bliss in a heavenly beyond is leaving this world behind. Why polish a sinking ship, asked D.L. Moody appropriately. It's no wonder Marxist and green social movements have decried that vision of heaven as the opiate of the masses, merely wishful thinking. The biblical narrative, however, has an unusual focus on this world, the life of heaven coming here, not us going there, God dwelling with us, not us leaving to be with God. Before getting too far ahead of myself, however, it's my exegetical responsibility to show that there is indeed continuity between the initial creation and the new creation. The book of Revelation is, of course, the most appropriate place to look, and the opening of chapter 21 deserves quoting at length. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is among humanity. He will dwell with them, and they shall be his peoples. And God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the former ways have passed away. And the one who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. I must say, this is simply beautiful. Some in the escapist camp, however, are quick to retort that the vision is not of this earth, but of a completely new earth. Verse 1, they decry, states that the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, that John saw a completely new heaven and a new earth. In other words, no continuity, only novum. I must digress. I can see how some might come to this conclusion. But my suspicion is that the corrupting influence of Greek Platonism is yet again creeping its way into Christian theology. Verse 5, in my humble opinion, holds the key to this passage. Behold, I am making all things new. It's worth noting that it doesn't say, I am making all new things, but it says, I am making all things new. On the contrary, then, this is seen most explicitly in the comparison between the opening chapters of Genesis and the concluding chapters of Revelation. In Genesis, we see a garden, an imperfect, unfinished, original creation. In Revelation, however, we see a redeemed, completed, and transformed city. And this city, we see in the next chapter, is home to the very tree of life which sustained those who ate from it in the opening chapters of Genesis. In other words, Eden, symbolically, is restored in the new creation of God, continuity and discontinuity. This has drastic implications for Christian ethics. Before diving into my proposal, however, it's first outlined the traditional approach to Christian ethics, protology. Traditionally, protology is understood to be the study of the origins and design, which often leads to conclusions regarding the purpose and function of the initial creation. Essentially, it makes claims on two levels: ontology, the study of being, and ethics, the study of doing. This next part's complex, but you'll have to bear with me. In academic vernacular, the descriptive is, derived from ontology, leads to the prescriptive ought for ethics. If something is a certain way ontologically, then it ought to behave ethically as such. As my mother used to tell me, you're an adult, act like one. So, this of course gets complicated in the Western tradition of Christianity when we seek to introduce the notion of the fall into the ontological realm of the created order. Following Augustine's understanding of Genesis, many in the West believe that the world was a certain way prior to the fall, but that it no longer is. In other words, Christian ethics in the West have sought to recreate the glorious past, the pristine state of the initial creation prior to the fall. To put this in contemporary political jargon we might understand, protology seeks to, quote, make creation great again. Joking aside, this method of protology discerns God's original design and function for the world through reading the opening chapters of Genesis and its particular reading of Romans 1, 19 through 20, which allows them to reflect upon the created world around them. Conclusions regarding family structure, gender roles, vocation, government, society, etc., can therefore be made by analyzing the, quote, remnants of the garden in the world around us. This method, however, operates under many problematic presuppositions which need to be addressed. One, creation before the fall was perfect in order and function. Two, the fall caused an ontological change in the physics, chemistry, and biology of the created order. Three, it is possible through human reason to discern the original order and function of creation prior to the fall and ground ethics in that recreated vision. Let's address these point by point. The notion that creation before the fall was perfect is rather difficult to agree with. In the Christian tradition, only God is understood to be perfect. Anything created, which by definition is less than God, would therefore be incapable of being perfect. At best, it could be said to have been created perfectly, but Genesis does not say this, but rather says the original creation was very good, not perfect. Moreover, as we heard previously, the entire trajectory and goal of God's purposes has always been toward the new creation. To use the symbolic language of Genesis to make my point, God's eternal purposes for creation were not to have two immortal naked people eating from the tree of life in an uncultivated garden, but were rather for humanity to cultivate not only the garden itself, but also the uncultivated wilderness outside of the garden's gates. In other words, humanity was always oriented toward the future, in which this creation would become the dwelling place of God, and their role as both the image of God and the image of the world was to prepare the way for that future. Two, even though most of us in this room would agree that the opening chapters of Genesis are not teaching either science or history, some still want to affirm the idea that an ontological change occurred in the constitution of creation at some point, whether the fall occurred, say, 6,000 or 100,000 years ago. Personally, I think this is expecting far too much from an ancient poem. While I agree that the notion of fallenness is a necessary theological concept, in addition to the notion of finitude, I don't think we need to go a step further and try to relocate the first fall in some prehistoric tribe of Neanderthals, or first humans endowed by God with a soul. Yes, the first sin in the biblical narrative was Adam's sin of misrepresenting God to Eve in the garden, but I don't think this epic poem has anything to say about human history, let alone an ontological change in the constitution of the world. And three, as I will get to in a few moments, grounding ethics in the initial creation does not take into account the novum of the new creation. In other words, if the new creation is the goal of all of God's creative purposes, then it must be the standard by which all human activity is deemed good and ethical. Why try to ground ethics in a fallen, original, and finite creation when we can ground ethics in the transformed and redeemed new creation? So what then is my alternative? I believe that ontological claims simply cannot sufficiently be made about an incomplete, unfinished, and finite initial creation, though there have been attempts by John Zazulis, Colin Gunton, and others at developing a relational ontology, which accounts for the current creation that is in flux. I believe that the only theological solution is to ground ontology in eschatology. In other words, we are not yet what we will one day be. Jürgen Moltmann and Wolfhard Pannenberg understood this well and believed that the future was ontologically prior to the present. To use an analogy, just as the essence of a flower is revealed only in its blossoming, a thing can possess its essence here and now only by anticipating what it will one day be in the eschaton. To place this in the context of our discussion on Easter, it could be said that Jesus' essence, if you will, is not revealed in the incarnation of his birth, but is rather revealed in his resurrection. His birth acquires its meaning and significance only in light of his future, which includes his death and resurrection. And its significance is revealed in the anticipation of that future. What implications would this have for Christian ethics? In protology, the descriptive is derived from ontology and leads to the prescriptive ought for ethics. If something is a certain way ontologically, then it, or at least was in the initial creation, then it ought to function as such. In eschatology, however, the descriptive is not grounded in the ontology of the initial creation, but is instead found in the ontology of the transformed new creation. Therefore, it's not that we were a certain way ontologically. It must seek to recreate that. But it's that we will be a certain way ontologically in the new creation. It must orient ourselves toward that end. The prescriptive ought for eschatology, then, is forward-looking rather than backward-looking. Subsequently, since ethics is not rooted in examining a fallen world for traces of the garden, but is instead rooted in the vision of the coming redeemed world, we must draw the hoped-for future into the transience and suffering of the present one. But what is the hoped-for future? It is none other than the eschatological vision outlined in the first half of this presentation. The creation, which Paul says is currently groaning in birth pains as it awaits its redemption, is the exact same creation which is envisioned in Revelation 21 as becoming the dwelling place of God. Likewise, the eschatological Sabbath discussed in Hebrews chapter 4 does not just include humanity, but it includes creation as well. This is seen in Leviticus 26, which discusses the Sabbath of the earth. The whole creation will share in the eschatological Sabbath rest of God, when God becomes, according to Paul, all in all. So if this, rather than a return to the garden, is our hope, then what can we identify as the most significant differences between protology and eschatology with regard to environmental ethics? One, whereas protology works on the basis of examining the world as it is, eschatology works on the basis of imagining the world as it will be. And two, whereas protology tells humanity to steward creation because it is a command of God, eschatology tells humanity that God will save the entire creation, and we ought to treat it accordingly. In conclusion, I want to end with a brief comment on 2 Chronicles 36, 19 through 21. Here it declares that the reason the nation of Israel was exiled, was into Babylonian captivity, was because the Israelites had disregarded the Sabbath of the earth. If we today continue to disregard the Sabbath of the earth by exploiting it through industrialism, nuclear weapons, chemical fertilizers, fracking, and pollution, we won't be as lucky as the Israelites to spend 70 years in exile. Instead, we're at the point where humanity may indeed come to an end so that the earth can celebrate its Sabbath. If we don't act to respect creation, the earth will survive, but perhaps humanity won't. May we not follow any further in the footsteps of the Israelites, and instead remember that this creation itself is the future dwelling place of God, and orient our lives toward preparing the way for that end. Thank you.
Go ahead and step here. So we have questions for Matthew. Back there.
So our eschatological ontology, mm-hmm. would you consider that to be perfection?
Yeah. Well, we are sharing in the perfection of God. It's not an inherent possibility within creation itself, but it's a possibility opened up by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So we participate in the inner life and the perfection of the Trinity, and that's our perfection.
We had another question there.
In the slide just previous to this one, you had an ought in there that I wonder if there's enough information. You say, God will save the entire creation, we ought to treat it accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do we fill out that ought? Where's the data that tells us what ought means in that sense?
Well, you use the word data. This is a science conference, and I'm a theology guy, so that's an important epistemological difference. I think the new creation is not bound by the physics of this current one. It's a transformation of the physics of this current creation. But it is this creation which is saved. And so we need to envision the day where there is no more suffering, transience, death, tears, mourning, crying, death. The day where all of creation experiences the universal shalom promised in the Old Testament. And the jubilee of Leviticus, where all debts are released, land is restored to its rightful owner, and the earth itself is able to not be exploited. And basically, my proposal would be we have to naturalize humanity, not humanize nature. We need to realize that humanity is a part of nature. We are a part of the doctrine of creation. We sprung forth from creation, the creative capacities of creation. And so we need to stop having a doctrine of man and a doctrine of creation and seeing these things as basically antithetical. I think they need to be brought together into one theological doctrine. I agree first.
Don't misconstrue this.
Yeah.
It's not intended to be an attack in any way. If we view the prologue as a symbolic, poetical expression of truth, what's to prevent us from viewing Revelation 21 in a similar light and not, not address it as literally as maybe the presentation suggests?
I believe that, and if it didn't come across this way, then I apologize, that my goal with the Revelation is to also interpret it symbolically. It's apocalyptic literature, but it's also letters to seven churches. So it's an epistle, it's apocalyptic, and it's also liturgical. It's about worship. It's about worshiping the one true God, not Caesar. So there's all sorts of dimensions going on in Revelation. And so my goal is to basically take out the symbolic themes in Revelation and then to theologize with that. So my grounding of the fact that creation itself is going to be saved is the fact that the tree of life is present in Revelation 22. It's a restoration of the garden symbolically, but it's also a transformation into something new. But it also bears the marks of creation itself, in the fact that Christ still has the scars of his crucifixion, and we have the resurrections of our own body, and it's a city, not a garden. Who makes cities? Not God, people. Our work is saved. The things that we do in this life all matter. The mundane, the things that we don't typically count as spiritual, will be wrapped up in the resurrection of God, because when God saves us, he doesn't just save our inner spirituality, our soul. He saves the totality of our being. My totality, the gestalt, if you will, in German, is basically the sum total of my relationships between my friends, my peers, my family, this conference. And my gestalt also includes my relationship with creation itself and the things that I produce through my human work. Yes?
Jesus taught us to pray that God's kingdom would come on earth as in heaven.
Yeah.
And isn't the Sermon on the Mount essentially a description of the ethics of that kingdom?
Yes.
Which Revelation 21 is
the consummation. Yes. So my understanding of biblical ethics, how the ethics are done in the Bible, differs between different biblical authors, but there's a trajectory involved. Even the commands in Genesis themselves are already eschatologically oriented toward the future. The God of Israel slowly prepares the way toward preparing them for the revelation of God in Christ. And so Jesus's revelation to the people on the Sermon on the Mount is already an eschatological message. He's saying, if you want to anticipate the eschaton in the present, this is what it is. It's the kingdom of God that's in your midst, it's near, it's at hand. These are the things that we need to be doing if we want to anticipate that future. But I want to qualify that by saying not everything then is going to equal the same that it is now in terms of ethics. There's going to be differences based on different contexts as well.
Let's one last one, then we need to let our next speaker go.
I'm not a theologian, but just wondering, just so I understand what your point are you, as far as I know, the Christian history, at least in recent history, has been, as far as creation goes, based on dominion, and we will take dominion over creation.
Yeah.
And I wonder, am I understanding you right, that your point is a little bit like C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, that as mankind takes dominion over creation or nature, nature in the end will take dominion over mankind. And so, is that right, that you are kind of reversing that dominion theology?
One thing I wished I did, I addressed in the presentation is that reading nature, protology, to determine God's will, has been used in the past for such things as legitimizing slavery, the so-called manifest destiny of the American settlers, the oppression of women, and the exaltation of the Aryan race. And I think the dominion of creation itself is bound up in protological ethics, this divine command, all we have to do is read nature, Romans 1, and we can determine our role in it. And I think typically humanity, when they read nature, they always do it in a way that privileges themselves. And I'm saying that it's the new creation, where we are finally brought back into our rightful place, one small corner of the four corners of the earth, that we can coexist with nature and function appropriately. So, thank you.
Thank you, Speaker, again here.